What's up, y'all? Kevin Kuhn here from Athlete Factors. This is the Athlete Factors podcast, and I'm here with my good friend, Dr. Ian. What's up?
Hey, man.
How are we doing?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm very well. You are a physical therapist. Is that correct?
I am. Yes, sir.
Nice. So tell us just a little bit about yourself, and then and then we'll kind of jump into what we're here to discuss today.
All righty, cool. My name's Ian. I'm a physical therapist at University of Miami, and I work in a pain management facility. So down the hall from me are both anesthesiologists and PM&R physicians. And so it's sort of a multifaceted, or the idea behind it is to eventually become a more well-rounded, multifaceted comprehensive clinic. At the time, we kind of all exist in separate silos, but we do get referrals from those doctors. And being in the same office allows us to kind of communicate and educate. As well as the unique thing about the facility I'm in is that it is sort of butts up to a wellness center. So I'm on the medical campus, and the wellness center was essentially designed for medical students, but it's because it's designed for medical students who are in class or in the clinics during the day, it stays relatively empty. So I have this humongous fitness facility that I have access to all day with my patients. So it kind of creates this really unique environment where we have this sort of quiet, sort of more dimly lit space that opens up to a completely glass, you know, well-lit, huge, comprehensive wellness center. So kind of creates a cool dynamic with patients who have pain, because you can sort of transition in and out of this sort of well space and this more sick is probably the wrong word, but more of a care oriented space. But anyway, so yeah, I work in this facility, graduated from University of Miami. I stayed a year after graduating and did an orthopedic residency program. And this particular program was sort of unique in that the design of the program wasn't just orthopedics and manual physical therapy. There was a major component of the program that was centered around pain science. And so what really drew me to the program wasn't any of those three things, but the guy who kind of became my mentor during the process of finishing a physical therapy school through internship experience was the director of that residency program. And I saw the attention he put into developing clinical reasoning and just becoming a better critical thinker in the clinic versus being a superstar orthopedic clinician or a superstar manual physical therapist. He kind of wanted to take those skills and try to take these residents to an area of higher learning and deeper appreciation for like the nuances and the rationale behind what you're doing. And I could see that as a student, and I knew I wanted more of that. So I stayed and did that program. When I finished that program, I took an opportunity to go move out to Colorado for a year. And I was working in a hospital-based facility in a really cool part of Colorado, southwest Colorado. And I was seeing one patient an hour, and I got to really spend a lot of time taking all that stuff I learned in residency and sort of unpacking it on my own. Nice. And working one-on-one, which is sort of like the physical therapy dream, right, to be in one-on-one situations. But unfortunately, the situation at that hospital sort of changed. They kind of went through restructuring a lot during my time there, and so the opportunity to come back to University of Miami as part of the orthopedic residency as a faculty member to both mentor and teach came up, and I had just gotten married. My wife was looking to maybe be in a bigger hospital, and it just worked out that we could kind of go back there, and so now we're back in Miami, and I'm in there in a new role and really enjoying it right now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So we go way, way back, don't
way,
we?
Way, way back.
Yeah. Back to
probably like 11 or 12 years back.
Yeah. It had to be what, 2000 and let's see. Okay. So I graduated high school 2005, and then I did Tough Camp as a counselor in between my, I can't remember if it was freshman or sophomore and junior. It was sophomore and junior year, because the next summer I was here in Dallas. So that would have been 2007. I was a camp counselor for Athletes in Action Tough Camp at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. And you were a camp attendee.
I was. Certainly. I must have been junior in high school, I think.
Yeah.
Going into my junior year of high school.
Crazy. So we got to spend lots of late nights, cracking it up, walking around campus, getting in trouble, but not really getting in trouble. We were pretty calm, pretty.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of cross country kid trouble.
I remember kids being like, "Hey, can you sneak us off campus so that we can go watch Harry Potter?" And I was like, "No, I don't want to get in trouble."
So
as if that was the worst thing.
So I gotta be honest with you. There was a year, it might have been the year after that, where a group of us did sneak off in the middle of the night, and we went and saw like the new Batman or something like that. It wasn't even, again, modest cross country good trouble. But I think we like secretly took the elevators to the basement, crawled out a window that we had left open the night before, earlier that day, and like went to the movie and came back.
Nice.
Super ridiculous.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, good times.
That was so fun. And then I came back and did it the summer after I graduated. But so you had already, I think, graduated at that point as well.
Yep.
But I still think you came through on beach day for a
visit,
which was awesome. Yeah. So
yeah, I really enjoyed that experience. That was a fun camp.
Yeah.
But and that process getting to know you was pretty cool, because you were sort of like always a few years ahead of the areas of interest that I had and the kind of the career paths that I was thinking about and pursuing. So fun to have somebody kind of a couple years ahead of you kind of paving a trail and getting to kind of watch and learn from.
Yeah, I hope that I had some influence on you in a positive way, but for basically as long as I've known you, I think you've always wanted to do physical therapy. So I didn't really have any encouraging direction to push you in that way. I think you just always wanted to do that. But as far as, you know, learning things before you get to school and learning things outside of the classroom during your undergrad, I hope I was an encouragement there.
For sure, without a doubt. And to be honest with you, when we talk about like learning outside the classroom, to this day, a lot of what I'm interested in learning and the things that I'm trying to pull from are physiology concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like to try to adapt physiology context or concepts and make those concepts work for rationalization of the choices I make in the clinic. So a lot of that still comes from conversations that we have.
Yeah. I still remember, when was it? Must have been 2011, probably summer of 2011 when I was in Indianapolis and you and Kevin came to visit, and like we just always, you know, stayed in touch. Like there's times where, you know, both of us are busy and we're doing our own thing, but
for sure,
we're still able to, you know, keep the conversation going, and
I think
it feels like we're picking up right where we left off.
Exactly. That's what I think, too. I was just thinking about that earlier today. It's been a couple of years. There's been a lot that's changed since we last talked. But it's easy to just pick up where we left off and kind of update each other and go. So I always appreciated that.
For sure, man. So I would love for you to educate me and all my watchers / listeners on pain. So tell us about pain, what it is, the different types, and how you evaluate it, how you treat it, and.
So as a physical therapist in particular, but as a health and wellness professional as a whole, pain is probably the most important thing or the most common thing that we see clinically speaking. I mean, even if you're not treating someone for pain, if you're talking about performance, at some point in time, an athlete has experienced pain, most likely. Mm-hmm. And so I think pain is a field that's growing at a super fast rate, at least the understanding of pain from a physiologic perspective and from and being able to address pain is growing. And a lot of that is obviously driven by pharmaceutical things, but I think in the world of health and wellness, it's emerging as a another way to effectively treat pain that goes beyond prescribing a medication or providing an injection. And I think it's super important for the progression of our healthcare model to have health and wellness professionals be addressing pain. And so I think the first and foremost, most important thing to impart about pain is an output, not an input. And so nociception, which is what we classically, the sensation that we experience that we classically attribute to pain, is not necessary or sufficient to create a pain experience. And so we know that from studies like where they've used mirrors and rubber hands and smashed them, and people have experienced pain, right? Or you hear stories of like heroic feats where someone pulled a car up off their baby after a car accident, saved their life, you know, that kind of thing. And we know that that pain experience is something that can be overridden by more pressing issues, or can be sort of influenced by the threat of pain, not just an injury itself. So hurt does not equal harm is a super important concept when it comes to understanding pain. And so I think that's first and foremost, one of the most important things to know is that pain does not require there to be an input, it's an output. And so moving forward with that, as we try to become better at treating pain, there's been this push to sort of classify pain to better understand how to kind of break apart someone's pain experience and better explain and rationalize how to treat it. And so I sent you an article to kind of prep us. I talked about breaking down pain. And so there's been some changes from maybe what most listeners who are familiar with pain have learned, and that is that there's sort of these three primary pain mechanisms. Number one being nociceptive. Number two being neuropathic. So nerve-related, and then the last one being what was used to be termed central is now being called nociplastic, and that's the idea that sort of pain without known origin, or pain that's persisted beyond normal tissue healing times, or pain that extends beyond the area of anticipated tissue damage or injury, and so that's an area that where I think becoming a better understander of the science of pain is important in getting to that next level and treating those patients. So first and foremost, I think we're all in the health and wellness industry familiar with the idea of nociceptive pain, right? The issues in the tissues. So we kind of have three broad or subcategories of nociceptive pain, and that would be inflammatory, ischemic, and mechanical. And so when you think about those three categories, you can kind of break that down a little bit. And so mechanical is true tissue irritation or damage, right? So you're talking about something like a broken finger, right?
And for those who can't see, Ian just showed that he has, in fact, a broken finger.
inflammatory, I think we're all familiar with, right? The lateral ankle sprain, the boggy swelling that you get after that experience. Mm-hmm. And then ischemic, if you're thinking ischemic, you're thinking lack of blood supply. And so something like when you experience a increased muscle tone in an area, or quote unquote, like someone who's got a guarding response or a cramp, that might be an ischemic experience associated with pain. And you could take that all the way down the road towards someone who has peripheral vascular disease and is having, you know, leg pain because of that. Ischemic is just another classification for an issue in tissue that relates to lack of blood supply. And so within those things, I think we're all pretty good at coming with the ideas and ways you could treat those things. So we've talked about, like in my lecture, I talked about, I go as broad as like using an anti-inflammatory for inflammatory pain, using repetitive isotonic activity to try to create a muscle pump to flush tissue out of there, or not tissue, but you know, like the chemical inflammatory soup that occurs after an injury. Or using massage as a way to kind of flush things out of there. So I think we can all come up with pretty good ideas or ways to kind of break that down. And I think that is important. And then the deeper you get into treating patients, the more interested you are in treating patients with pain or clients with pain, the better it probably is to have a good foundational understanding of physiology. But you can take that physiology and you can rationalize these treatments to become that much more effective at educating your patient or educating your coworkers or coming up with a rationale that becomes progressive over time in regards to how you treat that patient today and next visit, 5 visits from now, 10 visits from now, you know, at time of discharge, how you're kind of formulating that plan. I think it's important to pull from having a good rationale, and that should be hopefully grounded in some good physiologic understanding of what's going on. But it's not necessary to be so deep, at least if you have a good understanding of kind of the general process of what's going on.
Right.
So I think that's the most important part, is if you can kind of understand some of these concepts, these classification schemes, if you can hone in on the physiology, even better. But knowing that you're kind of treating an inflammatory thing and that differs from an ischemic thing or differs from a mechanical thing, or it's in concert with one of those things, it's important to understand and start to break that down. So that's first and foremost, long-winded answer for that's kind of notes you step to pain. We also have, like I said earlier, like neuropathic pain. And again, that can be broken down. So neuropathic means generating from nervous tissue. And we know that nervous tissue is the most bloodthirsty tissue in the body. And so ischemic obviously plays a major role in nerve tissue. But so can mechanical irritation of nerve tissue. And an inflammatory response surrounding nerve results in changes in axoplasmic flow and other things related to the nerve that are super important for nerve conduction. So again, the deeper you go in physiology, the better and the more sound your rationale can be. But knowing the difference between a mechanical irritation, ischemic irritation, inflammatory environment, and how to sort of impact those, which I think, again, health and wellness professionals are pretty well suited and ready to do, super important. The thing that gets a little bit trickier is as pain persists, and it's been around for a prolonged period of time, you have further changes up the network that leads to the brain. So remember, pain is an output, not an input. So the input is still sensory information. Mm-hmm. Your brain's job is to gather that information and determine an appropriate response. But over time, that barrage of input can cause a cascade of changes in the peripheral nervous system, but as well as the central nervous system, that lead to further complications. And so we see increased spread of the painful area as one of those things that can change if pain persists. We see altered movement patterns and coordination if it's, you know, been persisting in the somatosensory cortex, the brain starts to become a little bit altered as a result. We see things like what we call a wind-up phenomenon, where repeated stimulus to that area quickly ramps up in terms of severity of pain because that input is starting to become more and more noxious to the body. And so all of those things, this is the separation now between nociplastic and central, those two terms, is all of those things are susceptible to the central nervous system processing changes, whether you have a nociceptive injury, a neuropathic injury, or what we deem as nociplastic, which is pain that, again, is sort of inconsistent with tissue damage. It extends way beyond the anticipated period of pain. It's pain that occurs with unanticipated activities or movements. It's sort of that pain without a clear understanding of what's causing it.
Yeah.
So that term central has almost been pulled away from being its own mechanism, because all of those things over time have the ability to lead to central processing changes that now it's almost like a continuum underneath the umbrella of each one of those things.
Gotcha.
But over time we can see these changes.
So can you give us a basic example of an injury or a disease or condition, whatever the case may be, for each of those categories of pain?
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't we start with a nociceptive case. So the issues in the tissues, the one that we all kind of have some familiarity with. And let's start with a lateral ankle sprain. I think that's an easy analogy, right? So there is a There's clearly a nociceptive inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. There may have been a nociceptive mechanical, obviously, injury, right? The ligament disruption. Mm-hmm. And so let's say there it's a lateral ankle sprain. It's a recurring event for them. Let's say it's your basketball player, high school basketball player who has recurrent lateral ankle sprains. So they're presenting to you. They got this boggy, swollen ankle. It's been a few days. Again, it's something that occurs a little bit frequently. So they're pretty kind of accustomed to experiencing that, dealing with it for a couple of days and getting back on the court. So they walk in. They've been in pain for, like I said, for a couple of days, and you're seeing them. They, like we said, they had inflammation that you can see is still persisting. And so in regards to trying to effectively manage that, you're thinking you're going to want to – so we'll get into this a little bit later too, but there's sort of some different levels that I want you to think about patients or clients on as well in regards to almost like a continuum of like where to apply your rationale and how that might impact the treatment decision you made. So let's start with like sort of like treating on the molecular or cellular level. So you're trying to treat that swollen ankle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might start off with something like making sure that they have talked to them about talking to their doctor, or that they're using some kind of over-the-counter anti-inflammatory to help reduce that pain.
Mm-hmm.
You might be suggesting again to get that, make sure that they're doing a good job of kind of getting hold on there and trying to slow down that cascade. So that you now have the treatment window to try to help reduce as much of that swelling as possible. Mm-hmm. You may use a little bit of like manual therapy, massage, joint mobilization to try to kind of help flush some of that swelling out and provide a little bit of proprioceptive input with that joint mobilization. And then again, maybe like some repetitive isotonic activities, some ankle heel raises to try to help further flush the system, kind of get blood moving back towards the heart.
Muscle pump and
yeah,
all
muscle
that
pump.
Action.
Mm-hmm. And so that might be that first line of thinking with that patient is okay, I'm going to kind of do whatever I can to help reduce swelling and get them moving normally.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's say they show up, that it's been a couple of days, that pain is now, it's a little bit more intense in nature, it's a little bit more widespread. You can tell that this has become a little bit more of a significant impacting thing on this patient. Maybe mm-hmm. we're dealing with a little bit of some of those early changes, the peripheral sensitization changes. And so you're thinking, okay, I'm seeing that this peripherally, this guy's nervous system is a little bit heightened as a result of some of the chemical mediators that have been the barrage of input we're getting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this may be somebody who you're starting to kind of use things like maybe some of the same exact concepts, but we're also starting to use some things like prolonged aerobic exercise to help further flush some of those things and get them feeling good, getting some of those good, like, feel-good exercise hormones going. We're trying to also perhaps start to educate them on the importance of some of these things. And remember the whole concept of hurt versus harm.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if there's some increased or heightened peripheral awareness of what's going on with this pain experience, educating them on the importance of early mobilization after an ankle sprain, keeping moving well, and the whole hurt versus harm concept could be really important at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And then further down the chain, we're starting to have some of these central nervous system processing changes. This may become a patient where you start to change the lens in which you're looking at dosing what you're doing with this patient, and maybe this is someone who needs to start off with just sort of what we call graded exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're being really careful about their tolerance to activity, because mm-hmm. there is the potential to move backwards in regards to their pain experience if we're pushing them too hard too fast. So ideally you get somebody moving early after an ankle sprain, but if you're starting to see some of these signs of central sensitization, you may be taking the same patient and taking a step back and saying we want to be kind of careful in how we're grading or dosing the activity that we're having them do.
Mm-hmm.
We may also give them other assignments depending on what you're seeing related to making sure that we're creating safe movement experiences. So that it could go all the way as far back as something we call lateralization, where you're using motor imagery tasks or you're using mirror-based therapy to kind of ensure that the patient, that the threat of movement is sort of downplayed to the brain so that we can start to kind of try to change some of the way that the brain is processing this information and create a less threatening environment. So that's like taking that original nociceptive inflammatory injury, that quick early ankle sprain, and trying to kind of take it to the continuum there. We're talking about, let's say, the same exact injury, but it wasn't an ankle injury or it wasn't a ligamentous injury that's causing their pain experience. It's actually this kid who has had recurrent ankle sprains, and this time, because the ligaments have already been damaged over time and are really not quite as taut as they were, you know, before all his recurrent ankle sprains, this time he's got a traction injury of the nerve. And so you're thinking, we've got true mechanical damage to nervous tissue. We may not treat it any different than we treated the ankle in regards to trying to manage inflammation swelling in the area and creating an environment for healing. But the rationale behind what I'm doing could be thing that changes, right? So if I'm thinking he's got nervous tissue injury, I want to make sure the nerve is moving really well. And so maybe that's where I'm really focusing in on normalizing range of motion early so that we have good glide and slide of the nervous tissue. We're trying to get rid of that inflammatory environment so the nerve has a chance to heal and recover. We're making sure there's good blood flow in the area because, again, nervous tissue is the most bloodthirsty tissue in the body. That would probably be where I would say if you were to take that same ankle and look at it from a neuropathic standpoint, assuming that you know, a traction injury was possible, which it is. It's actually a lot of times one of the things that in recurrent lateral ankle sprains that goes misdiagnosed or undiagnosed is that, you know, there's a traction injury there. And then lastly, if we were to take a nociplastic case, so I have we'll shift to the low back. I had this patient that we treated. She had a massive disc protrusion. She was treated for low back pain conservatively and was having things like foot drop associated with the protrusion. And it was just at a point where, yeah, surgical management was definitely warranted. So she had the surgery. She came back. We rehabbed her after the surgery. She was discharged doing well. Year goes by, and we get her back in the clinic. A couple of things have changed. Work life has changed a little bit. So there's some stress associated there. Living with mother-in-law has been an added stressor. Mm-hmm. Baby's getting into terrible twos, so they've got a lot more going on there. Mm-hmm. Maybe some personal spousal stuff going on that briefly kind of touched on that could be causing some added stress, has clearly gained a bit of weight. Mm-hmm. Had, you know, one of the primary things that had bothered her from prior to the injury was that her lifestyle after baby had changed quite a bit. She went from being a routine CrossFit athlete to not participating in exercise. And so we've seen some of the sedentary lifestyle behaviors starting to kind of manifest. Mm-hmm. And then poor sleep quality, not paying attention to diet, kind of living in the in this crisis mode all the time, right? Just kind of surviving every day, not really thriving. And so comes in. Again, we had successful course of intervention prior to injury, or not prior to injury, but after surgical management. Mm-hmm. And so here we are with back pain, limiting quality of life. And so upon doing an evaluation, not seeing pain with active range of motion, not seeing seeing some generalized changes in terms of strength and endurance, mostly associated with just sedentary behaviors and under chronic stress, but not seeing a lot of clear pathological or tissue-based issues showing up.
Right. And nothing was standing out for why you should be experiencing back pain.
But when you're talking about this cumulative load of stress, you start thinking about, man, what impact could this be having on your autonomic nervous system, cardiovascular system, your endocrine system, all of which we know are super interrelated. And so changing focus a little bit in regards to what we're treating here, decided to take her through an exercise tolerance test, So got her up to steady state with something that was moderately to vigorously intense. Took peak heart rate. Looked at heart rate 1 minute later, 2 minutes later, 4 minutes later. Wasn't seeing the return to baseline we'd want to see.
So, wow, so just staying elevated.
Staying elevated. So you know that right then and there that there's something going on with our cardiovascular system. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about muscles, right? We're talking about the background muscles that have a largely type 1 profile because we're talking about things that are related to posture. Mm-hmm. And so you're starting to think, okay, you know, obviously tissue quality is going to be impacted by poor cardiovascular response, but perhaps this poor cardiovascular response is primarily driven by autonomic nervous system change. We're talking about this huge allostatic load, huge cumulative load of stress, then maybe this is where we need to kind of start. And so I kind of took her through this progression of, and this is where I was kind of starting to formulate thoughts about kind of the way which we address pain like this and progress this patient back to the lifestyle they want to live, or the client back to the lifestyle they want to live. And so first and foremost, we identified that there was a clear problem in whether you want to call it a molecular cellular physiology or you want to call it systems physiology. Mm-hmm. Either way, you got to break it down. You know there's a change there, right? Mm-hmm. So I started off with essentially not necessarily directly intervening at the back, kind of starting with conditioning. So we would do some things to try to create a little bit of an autonomic nervous system response, endocrine response. And so and whether you're impacting one or the other, it doesn't really matter because they're so intertwined that you're changing something.
Getting both, yeah.
And so I want to pick your brain on this first. Let's stop for a second, and it'll make sense into what I was doing or trying to do. So when we talk about, I listened to a couple of your podcasts, and in one of them, you were talking a little bit about cortisol, the cortisol response. Mm-hmm. So from my understanding of cortisol response is that under cumulative chronic exposure to stressors, cortisol spikes, right? Because we use cortisol to mobilize glucose stores, right? Mm-hmm. To get out of a threatening situation, ideally, in caveman world. And then if it stays elevated for a prolonged period of time, what eventually happens, instead of just staying elevated, it flatlines. Mm-hmm. And so you actually become a non-responder. And so when you experience stress, or you hope to experience something that's parasympathetic, you're not responding to either. You're kind of flatlined. And wow. So sort of along the lines of like glucose and insulin and type 2 diabetics, that relationship.
Wow.
And so at least from some of the stuff that I've been reading. And so what I'm attempting to do with impacting those systems is hopefully create sort of these, I don't want to use the word artificial because they're creating true stress, but to create these highs and lows within a session. And so what I'll do is like take her, this patient, for example, and get her on a bike or whatever piece of cardio equipment seems to work best in terms of, you know, her interests, mm-hmm. what doesn't cause exacerbated pain, all those things into account, mm-hmm. and take her through some intervals. And then immediately following that, try to create parasympathetic response. So let's return to the mat table. This is maybe where we mix in some hands-on manual intervention. Maybe this is where we introduce some diaphragmatic breathing or some guided meditation, something to kind of create this nice, calmer sort of parasympathetic response. And then we hit it again. We try to create these spikes in our sessions. And I'm hoping that whether I'm causing true autonomic disruption and getting her back on some kind of diurnal sort of response, or if I'm just impacting her endocrine system by taking her through high intensity intervals and I'm just getting some kind of response there, I'm hoping that I'm impacting those three systems and that by tracking heart rate recovery, we can see if there's been true change.
Yeah.
I use that as kind of my outcome measure and then take her through some sessions like that. So we started there with just like maybe two or three bouts in an hour session. Mm-hmm. So we start to see a little bit of improvement and then from there, it's pretty obvious, pretty quick that like, while this is cool for me, at some point in time, this is gonna be boring as heck for my clients, right? We keep doing this back and forth.
I'd be so excited to be doing this, like not as the patient, but
right,
as the
right.
This sounds so cool.
And then, but you know, she's there, and you're like, well, I gotta make this about her. So So then I started to play with, like, okay, so what was she into before this all happened? She was into CrossFit. So let's substitute these high-intensity intervals for circuits. Now I make it a little bit more meaningful for the patient. So now I'm kind of progressing more towards the individual level, right? So I'm treating the person in front of me, not the system or the cellular physiology. Again, the whole time, of course, I'm treating the patient. But at the end of the day, the way my rationale is sort of focused, I kind of shifted to, like, okay, if I'm going to keep doing this, I have to kind of surround the patient with what she wants to be part, you know, to get her to buy in and keep her moving. And so then we start to play with some of those things. Before you know it, couple of weeks of sessions go by, and I don't know how we got there, but we're progressing to, like, show me a snatch, show me a clean.
Yeah.
Hey, you know you did that without back pain? Oh yeah, I guess I did. All right, so you know, maybe this back pain that you've been experiencing this second time around had not a whole lot to do with true tissue pathology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sure, there are some concepts there that we can talk about, like I said, with tissue perfusion, of these lumbar paraspinals or lumbar spinal stabilizing musculature. But at the end of the day, I don't know that after a pretty thorough evaluation, an hour evaluation, that was her pain driver, which at the end of the day, I think is what I'm really trying to get at here, is how do you determine the pain driver, your focus, where you're going to start with patients like this who have this pain experience that isn't well explained, or like that you can tie down to a movement impairment or a repetitive activity that's causing them pain. Maybe it's something a little bit different. So we did that for a while, started moving pretty well there. And you know, we're really getting close to time for discharge, at least from a physical therapy standpoint. Can't really justify insurance while my patient's cleaning without pain, but I'm keeping her around, right? So, but I've developed a relationship with this patient at this point in time, but you know, you're developing sort of this very individualized approach. I'm trying to stay on the cutting edge of science, and I'm geeked as hell to be working with this patient. So
yeah,
what do we do now?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, hopefully you have somebody, a trusted professional that you kind of transition her care to, somebody like you. I could say, like, Kev, I got this girl.
Mm-hmm.
CrossFit, what do you think? But this point of life she's at, where she's living with mother-in-law, she's primary care provider for a two-year-old and working her butt off, she just wanted something to do on Saturday morning. So we figured out that there was a run club in town nearby that met on Saturday mornings, and so we went a couple times together.
Nice.
Things went well. She got some confidence. She got to meet some of the people, and then transitioned into becoming a regular attendant of that run club. And so the hope would be that as we shift through, that the very last stage, right, so we saw the individual and treated the individual, trying to kind of meet her needs and her demands for sport or for leisure. But at the end of it, that there's some kind of communal outlet they can participate in. At least from my perspective, if I can't find somebody like you, like a trusted healthcare professional, to kind of pass the baton to, she can find a group to kind of find that to continue with. And so, again, long-winded answer for nociplastic pain, but we're talking about nociplastic pain, we're talking about pain that doesn't have this clear origin. It's kind of this messy presentation of pain. And that's, truthfully, that's kind of where I live right now in terms of my working world. I get some post-op stuff, and that's a blast because, you know, again, issues in the tissues, we know what it takes to load tendon, and we know what it takes to load and adapt muscle. Let's go get it. And respect the healing times your doctor's surgical protocol outlines. But most of the patients I get have multiple comorbidities, have been in pain for a really long time, and look really messy on paper when you get them in the clinic. And I think we do a pretty decent job of teasing that stuff out, at least where I'm at, where I've got some people that are pretty patient and pain-centered. And we just take our time and kind of use hypothetical deductive reasoning to generate a hypothesis on a pain driver and just kind of attack it and of course, adjust when things aren't looking the way that we thought they would. Mm-hmm. But having that foundational knowledge, I think, has been super important and has helped us create a good relationship with the pain management providers in our office to kind of keep patients coming in the door.
Dude, I think that's so cool that you were trying to, like, get that nervous system response and then follow it up with that autonomic nervous system response. Like, that just seems so cool to me. Like, and then repeat it. Like, this is the way I think about it. Because you were talking about how in those instances where cortisol will just flatline. With individuals who have desensitizations to specific hormones, like insulin, for example, like the insulin response is happening, but because glycogen stores are full and there's a lack of activity, now, you know, it's kind of like, this is one way that I explain it. Like, for somebody who's pre-type 2 diabetic or who's type 2 diabetic, it's kind of like the boy who cried wolf. Insulin is getting to the point where it's like, hey, I'm like trying to get this glucose into the muscle, but the muscle's full. So you keep sending me to do this job and then I can't do the job. So eventually I'm just going to stop. I'm just getting frustrated, right? So how do you resensitize the body to that? My guess is you can resensitize the body to not only producing cortisol, but it being not taken for granted, let's say, right? And I think a really good way to do that is to apply a very, very intense, potent training stimulus, but then being able to, like, in theory, this makes perfect sense to me, teach them how to have also the nervous system response where they can get into not just a mental mind state, but a physiological state that that drives recovery. And so doing that, you know, like most of the time we think about doing that, like, okay, you train really hard and then with your nutrition and with your sleep and with your, you know, your prehab stuff, your recovery stuff, you do your mental health stuff. Like, that's what you do in a day. And you're like saying, okay, yeah, that's cool. I'm going to do that multiple times within a training session.
Yep.
That's blowing my mind. That's blowing my mind, man. I think that's incredible.
I try to play with some of the other things too. Like, within that, typically what you'll find, it's almost like Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing, where I go from being super calm, soft-spoken, again, like that dimly lit room. Like, our clinic is a little bit of a yin and yang in that regard. Yeah. And I keep the room a little bit quieter, a little bit more dimly lit. We're relaxed. I might even throw a little bit of heat on them to kind of create that, again, another relaxing sort of thing.
Comfortable.
And then it's like, yo, heat's off, lights on, let's go. I'm a little bit louder. I'm more of a coach than I am a healer, if you will, you know,
yeah,
in that
yeah.
environment. And I'm like, let's go, come on. I'm yelling. We're not quiet. I mean, we're pushing. I'm trying to create stress.
Yeah.
And then we come back and then we go back down to being cool and relaxed and chill as a cucumber, you know, but.
Yep.
So we've been playing with that a lot, and I've tried to play a lot with, I want it to be meaningful. I want to make sure I'm actually able to kind of track change, right? So heart rate recovery for me has been the easiest thing to play with. Thought about playing with some of the other things that exist within this pain science world in terms of quantitative sensory testing. I just don't quite, we don't have norms. And so I don't quite have a handle on like how much use I would get out of that stuff. The thing with heart rate recovery that's tough is I would take that same girl and let's say her heart rate does respond fairly okay. It's like the minimum recovery, the baseline for like a normal recovery is 12 beats in a minute. But like if you're only coming down 12 beats in a minute, how conditioned are you really? That's a universal number. If I've gotten you to a decent peak, let's say it's a, you know, like a true test of your aerobic capacity, then how coming down 12, like, I don't think that's that impressive. And so there's some limitations there too, right? There's like there's a floor effect. That number is meant for everybody.
Sedentary, yeah. It's people an average.
Beta blockers are supposed to come down 12.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that number isn't, I think it's still not quite right.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to use heart rate variability, but in terms of taking a snapshot with heart availability, it's a crapshoot because I don't know what you drank today. I don't know what you ate today. Your appointment time could be different. The amount of traffic you went through could be different. All that stuff. So it'd be nice.
Your immune system, if you've been sick lately, like there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. If we were able to do continuous monitoring of heart variability, maybe we'd get a better number. But even the stuff I've read on the stuff that's out there, there's a famous, I'm not going to give you the name, but there's a wrist strap that people are using quite often now to kind of measure heart variability. But like, how valuable is that information at the wrist? How good is that data? Mm. Is it enough for a general trend? Maybe it is. But like, in terms of its accuracy, the amount of artifact with wrist movement, I don't know what you're getting. So mm-hmm. I don't know that we have a better tool right now other than heart recovery to use. Again, like I said, I kind of do like an inventory, like a wellness inventory. I want to know what your exercise routines are like. I want to know what your diet's like, your mm-hmm. hydration. I want to know about life stress. Sometimes that becomes its own like hour conversation because that starts to unravel some stuff. But yep. I think it's all super important. If we're getting to a point in our evaluation where the information you're telling me and the way I'm seeing you move isn't adding up to a clear picture of a pain generator, or I don't have a clear pain driver at this point, I like to kind of get into the weeds with some of that stuff and see how that might be impacting the patient's pain presentation. Gotcha. But I use terms like pain presentation and pain driver quite often. And what I'm trying to do with that is account for the fact that you may have multiple influences affecting your pain experience, right? So your pain experience could be influenced by a little bit of nociceptive mechanical sort of contribution, but also maybe in that process of that true tissue damage, you did have some kind of neuropathic insult. And, you know, again, that, considering that timeline, like we talked about, we kind of progress some patients through rather quickly, but like the getting to those central processing changes, I don't want to discount all the things that could be influencing your pain experience. Mm-hmm. But in terms of targeting what's going on with this patient, I like to use the term pain driver as sort of like the hypothesis of what I'm going to attack today, or what we're going to focus on in the initial part of our care plan or later in our care plan.
Gotcha. This is so intriguing to me because the idea, you know, has been so often like, oh, if this thing hurts, then you're in pain, so let's give you a painkiller. Or, you know, I think initially that was it. And then, you know, things evolved into like, oh, well, you know, maybe you have pain here because there's too much movement, or maybe it's because of a lack of movement. And now, like, it's this idea where, as humans, I think we always want to make things as simple as possible. We want Occam's razor all the time, right? But like, things are really complex, and like, pain can be an onion, and you've got to peel back these layers. And like, this whole idea of like, one of the things that stood out to me big time reading that article you sent me initially was this whole idea of the psychosocial. And I'm like, what the heck is this? Like, and then I'm starting to understand it a whole lot more. Like, you could have, you know, an injury where you're experiencing pain, and perhaps that pain is compounded because you're also going through something extremely psychologically stressful. Like, you know, as a collegiate athlete, you know, when I had an injury, I probably would have felt that injury much more had I also been going through finals, right? Like, so sure. It's stuff like that. Yeah. Like, so I love the way that you're explaining this and how you treat it. And it's like, yeah, there's these categories, and you've got to figure out like, okay, what's not only what is the correct tool for the job, but then what's the correct tool for the person for the job. And it's just like, you're applying the actual scientific method. Like, okay, does this work? No. Okay, let's try something else. Does this work? Oh, we're getting some traction here. Let's also add this thing in and see if we get more traction. And it's like, I feel like you're doing what all clinicians should be doing, which is using the scientific method, not just using a textbook.
Yeah, that's the goal. The goal is to try to make this all, and it's a constant pursuit. Like, there are days I come from work, I'm like, man, I'm doing a shitty job right now. Like, Like, I'm kind of stuck where I'm at. Like, I feel like my thinking's got to adapt. I got to think differently. One of the things we're doing right now that I think is super cool that I'm still trying to wrap my head around and understand better is this. A lot of this stems from, like I said, my mentor when I did that residency, who's just such an amazing clinical reasoner. He's kind of adapted his thinking from just thinking about some of these pain physiology things, starting to think a little bit different in the way that we look at pain from a medical perspective. And you said something earlier I want to touch back on, but he's looking at, like, why are doctors so efficient with their time? And a lot of people are listening to this are probably going to say, what do you mean? I would say, wait 45 minutes in their office every time I go to an appointment. Yeah, but when you get into their office, they're overbooked as it is. So that's part of the reason why you're waiting 45 minutes. When you get into their office, they typically see you in 8 to 15 minutes and you're out the door. They do a number of tests that are super quick, like temperature, blood pressure, heart rate. They're all biomarker-based. They've got biomarkers that give them shortcuts, right? Kind of addressing what's going on with you. If they don't know, they send you for labs. They get more biomarkers, right? And so in our world, I don't know what the laws are in Dallas or in Texas, I should say, for you or for physical therapists. But like in our world, we're still fighting for dry needling in physical therapy, which is super popular right now, which I think is an interesting somatosensory stimulus that we could go down the woods on. But right now in physical therapy, or in the state of Florida, I should say, we cannot penetrate skin. And so, like, there's some biomarkers that would be really interesting to gather in physical therapy. Like, we're limited in what we can take. But what we can gather that I think is interesting is respiratory variables. So we've started looking in our clinic at maximal inspiratory pressures, sustained inspiratory pressures. We're looking at end-tidal CO2, and looking at how those things might be impacting someone's pain presentation. And specifically looking at spinal pain with those things, but you could definitely adapt those things down the road to look at some other pain presentations as well, chronic shoulder pain, those kind of things. And so we're getting some interesting information from that, and there's some studies going on in our clinic looking at that kind of stuff. But again, a whole nother area to start to kind of think about and address is, man, your end-tidal CO2 is way below where it should be. What are we going to do about that? Like, how does that impact your pain presentation? So I love that stuff, and I think we're doing a cool job with it. It's up to me, though, to come home and spend time researching, understanding the physiology, and then trying to apply it in novel ways to figure out how I'm going to use it with my patients. And that's kind of where all that autonomic nervous system thought process started from, is thinking about what happens to cortisol over time, and then how might that impact my patient's presentation. But you talked about something interesting, and you talked about, you kind of like basically summed up the biomedical model in a nutshell, that like we give a painkiller, so it's like disease, target, kill, right? So we give them something.
Just mask it, cover it up.
Yep, or eliminate it, right? Yep. But, and we're just targeting the seed in the soil, right? But there's been a proposed shift. I'm not so sure, we talk about it a lot, I'm not so sure that it's successful yet, but the idea of the biopsychosocial model, or as some people are starting to reorganize it to be the socio-psycho-bio model, but that's a whole nother conversation too. But if you're shifting your thought process to treating the other things we're talking about, like the psychosocial constructs that may be associated with someone's pain experience, then you're starting to look outside of just those issues in the tissues sort of concepts, the nociceptive sort of approach. And you're thinking, how else might I structure my interventions or my care plan for this client or patient if I'm thinking about the whole person, you know, not just the issue, the hole in the patient, but the whole patient. And you're thinking more about stuff that you are already like been doing and excelling at. And that is, what about like nutrition, right? We're talking about all these autonomic nervous system potential inputs. We're talking about sleep. We're talking about nutrition. Like, those are soil-based interventions. That's not a disease target kill thing. And right. We're talking about people with chronic pain. Honestly, in the grand scheme of things, we've been pretty shitty to this point at treating chronic conditions, period. Chronic conditions, not just chronic pain, but chronic conditions. We, as a medical universe, suck at treating chronic conditions.
Yeah.
So when we break that down, like, there is totally a need for more of these soil-based interventions. And that's kind of what I lecture to. I talk about all the things that we just talked about with the residents in the ortho and sports residency that I lecture to. But I dive in on, like, starting to, like, think about some of these other ways that you might impact your patient's pain experience. Of course, you're still, like, I'm still staying, going to stay in my lane as a physical therapist. I'm not trying to say that I don't have any background in nutrition or dietetics, but if you're talking about, sleep and that kind of stuff, I'm limited in what I can give you some general advice, and I can present you the research, but, like, in terms of intervening, like, I'm not prescribing you a CPAP.
Right.
So at the end of the day, but if you could start to kind of coordinate, almost serve more like a medical liaison to your patient, mm-hmm. in addition to addressing what you can address in the clinic, the impact that you could have on your patient or client could be substantially improved, especially mm-hmm. these tough patients that come in that have these messy presentations, that have all these chronic, extensive comorbid profile, and you're thinking, like, shit, I hate when I get these chronic back pain, hypertensive patients. Well, maybe you just haven't been looking at it right. Maybe there's more going on here that we need to, like you said, the onion, you need to peel back. So I got that idea from listening to a really cool TED talk or a TED radio hour on rethinking medicine, and they're talking about rethinking cancer care and using what they call soil-based interventions for tumor growth suppression and kind of talking about it that way. And it just immunotherapies, that kind of stuff. And it just opened up this door to, like, well, man, there's so much of that you can do without ever penetrating the skin. Without ever going in and giving them a pill or an injection or removing injured tissue, there's so much you can do around that area to help promote healthier living. Yeah. At the end of the day, maybe all we're doing is modulating the nervous system with some of these chronic conditions, and that's what's leading to a change. They're creating a better environment around whatever has been ailing them, and then looking for the adaptations that we're making with exercise to kind of take hold.
Yeah, I think along those lines, man, kind of what you were saying before, when you were kind of getting to the point where you couldn't rationalize maintaining that client, like, it's time to let her go. If we don't have these systems where people like me are talking to people like you and creating these connections where, like, hey, I think it would be a really, really good idea to incorporate these aspects of, of potential benefit in your diet. I'm not the person that you need to talk to about it. I think this guy over here would really be able to help out. And I think incorporating that into what we're also doing here would be really beneficial. And, oh, by the way, there's this other dude over here who, he might be able to help you with time management, and that will help reduce your just general stress.
Yeah,
and, like,
sure.
So if when we're all better at that, and, like, that's why I love doing these podcasts. That was the reason I started this podcast, is to, like, expand my network so that when I have an issue with a client, I'm like, okay, I know enough to know that I need to reach out to somebody in this specific area. Like, there's enough overlap in what I do with this other profession to know that, okay, here's where my lane ends, but the lane right next to me, I need to send my client there. And like, you brought up nutrition. Like, there's tons of things that like, you want to talk about healing the tissues from the molecular level. That's dietary. I mean, like, that's, like, nutrients
for sure
drive adaptation. Like, you have to apply whatever stress you're going to in order to elicit, a change. But that's the first half of the equation. The whole second half is, in my opinion, is that's nutrition. That's the nutrients that come in to pay for the cost of adaptation, because repair and recovery has a physical cost, an ATP cost, and then You have to refuel the gas tank. You have to provide the substrate to repair, like the actual building materials to repair. Like if you're going to build a house, you not only have to get people on site to work, you also have to get the equipment, and then it has to be there at the same time. You can't have one show up, you know, like you can't have all the equipment there and then like no one there to work on the house and expect anything to get done. Like you need everything kind of all in the same place all at the same time. And when you're combining all of that, or when you have an idea of how they all fit together and work together, like that's how you make some serious significant change. And expanding the future practitioners' minds on that is going to be extremely beneficial for the human species down the road.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And I think, again, when we talk about, not to get political or anything, but when you're talking about the transformation, the future, whatever it's going to be or look like, transformation of our healthcare model as it exists right now, something's got to change, right? Something's got to change to drive down costs or change the way that we consume healthcare. And so being able to look at somebody and modify these things and get someone to healthier living, to help, or just to allow for optimal environment for adaptation is going to be such an important and critical thing. And so, you know, where I'm at, I think about this all the time because it's tough. Like, I love what I do. I really enjoy where I work and kind of the way in which I work, where I'm able to have a sort of a faculty role and a clinical staff role. But it's extremely tough to like look at the patients that I get in Metro Miami-Dade and be like, you know, some of you are not going to be able to afford these cash-based interventions that I think you'd benefit from.
Mm-hmm.
But like insurance doesn't pay for
cover it.
Some of these other things. And so it's like, well, like, what do I do? You know, I get to a point where it's like, I can't give you too much information because it's outside of my professional scope. I don't want to leave you high and dry. I gotta consider, you know, a discharge plan at some point in time, but at the same time, like, as a medical liaison, I'm not sure where I'm going to send you next or what we would do with you next. I think all physical therapists, I'm speaking on behalf of my profession exclusively on this. I think all physical therapists could get better at programming, understanding programming. I think we do a good job of like providing home exercise, but not like a plan for adaptation. Some of that is because you want somebody to seek out a professional who is skilled at programming, right? And can give you a plan that that they're making, that person's also employed and making a living and has the ability to make programming as part of their profession. But two, you want someone, I got to keep seeing patients. So I want someone who I can bridge those patients to, who can kind of take the healthy, well side and progress someone to remain healthy and well, or to physically perform at a level that they'd like to perform at. It's tricky. It's really tricky. I think, there are certain people that I know, like at the end of the day, when they walk out of this door, there's a good chance, all things considered, I might see them back here in 6 months or a year. Not because I don't think I did a damn good job of like giving them the tools they need, but because we don't have access to the resources that would benefit them best.
Yeah, there's a huge gap.
I have to remind myself from time to time that I have to, when I prescribe like a walking program, I have to double check that you have a safe place to exercise.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's a metropolitan area. I get patients who, that's simply something I have to consider from a demographic standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a safe place you can go for a walk at night? Maybe you don't. And that's something we have to figure out too. So it's an interesting multifaceted thing. But that's where I think truly we have to make the shift in thinking from biomedical disease target kill to biopsychosocial. What can I do surrounding the targeted disease, illness, injury to optimize adaptation and create change?
Dude, that's pretty amazing stuff.
It's been a lot of fun. It's kind of been a journey for me too, in terms of transferring the way I think. It all honestly all started from a I got assigned a lecture when I was in residency. We all had to do a certain number of lectures, and I got assigned a lecture on the topic of pain phenotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And that I still struggle with that term phenotype, because it's used, it's like overused term, but it's used to classify things. But from a genetic perspective, it, you know, it's the expression of a gene. And so that's where I went with this first lecture I did. I just did like this whole pain genetics lecture. And then they were like, no, man, we're talking about classification of pain. And I was like, okay, so let's adapt this genetics lecture. I don't want to throw it all out the window. I mean, I did a lot of work to try to understand the genetics of pain. So the next year when I came back and lectured as a guest lecturer, between becoming a faculty member and being a resident, when I was living in Colorado, I flew back and did a lecture. I kept the genetics thing, adapted it a little bit, but then started to progress it towards, like, how do we break down and understand and classify and rationalize what we're doing? And then now it's kind of become its own thing, where after hearing that TED radio hour and thinking a little bit about the way that I want to impact my patients, and I want to make sure that as I'm teaching the next group up, how they should be impacting their patients, I think it's super important to address so much more than just the issue in the tissues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a couple
more
things
complex.
To make sure in regards to the pain science conversation that we talk about. I think
for
we
sure.
talked about a lot of them. When we double back to the different pain mechanisms, this is maybe, I apologize, this is probably late in the conversation for listeners to be getting this, but we're doing our best job to hypothesize what we think is going on. We're using the evaluation, we're using the history and intake with the patient, and a functional movement screen, right, to gather as much information as we can and hypothesize what it is we think is the pain driver. But that being said, there are a number of, and in the article that I sent you, we talked about a little bit, or they talked about, I didn't have anything to do with that article, but some tests and measures that people are using to try to look at these different pain mechanisms. They talk about quantitative sensory testing. And again, the issue there, I did kind of mention this briefly, but is we don't have good norms for these numbers, right? And so right now, I think the thing that's lacking in regards to like targeting a pain driver is that we do not have diagnostic tools with great specificity for pain. We have tools, we have ways to kind of like assess and form my hypothesis, but they lack the specificity to say that, to draw conclusions, this is absolutely what's causing your pain. We're just doing our best job to try to target it and adapt and form a new hypothesis when necessary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's super important that we don't have direct measurement tools for these things right now. I want to impart that rationale is so important. I think if you take away anything from our conversation, it's that putting in the time and effort to develop a rationale for what you're doing is the game changer. I have this conversation with the residents usually pretty early when we're doing mentoring sessions in the clinic, and that is simply that because you chose to do 3 sets of 15 bridges on that mat table and I chose to do it, doesn't mean we chose it for the same reasons.
Mm.
You might have chose 3 of 15 and did bridges because you've seen another therapist do it and it works for back pain, right? I might have chose 3 sets of 15 because I'm trying to create a change in someone's energy systems, right? We set our sets and rep schemes are designed for energy systems. And so if I'm talking about lumbar stabilizing musculature, we're talking about muscles that need to have a good aerobic profile.
Mm-hmm.
And so my 3 of 15 may have been meant to create that change with short rest intervals in between sets to try to adapt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so making sure that you understand the rationale behind what you did and what I did. Maybe it's not so important today, we did the same exercise, but 2 visits from now, 3, 5, 10, discharge, it's all the difference in regards to how we got our patients where we got them to.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you a conscious participant in what you're doing, in a valuable person. If you can rationalize things, I think you're just a better, even if we chose the same exercises, you're better for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we talked about.
Yeah, there's context there and there's nuance there, and it helps big time when you understand the context, because like you said, like that might be because somebody just picks three sets of 15 every time. And yeah. It might be, you know, another person like, oh, this is the logical progression because in the last workout we did three sets of 12. And so now we're just progressing. Or, you know, it might be because, like you said, like that's, you're looking for a specific adaptation. And so it requires that setup. So,
yeah. And so the other thing I try to do, and I'd encourage anybody who's interested in trying to become better at their clinical reasoning skills, is I try to, we have a pro bono clinic at the hospital where I work. And so at nighttime, a couple days a week, the students, the graduate students run a pro bono clinic. And nice. And I, every once in a while, I'll get pulled to supervise the group. And so typically I use that time because they're all, you know, trying to learn to become physical therapists. So they're spending time learning all of this stuff in class, and then they're trying to apply it to one patient right in front of them that 1 hour. And usually it's a mess of excitement, right? Like, I've learned all this stuff. I want to try to apply all of it. Let's just do everything.
Do everything.
It ends up looking terrible. And it's not not because they're not trying hard, but because they just simply are trying too much, right? Yeah. So what I usually do is I'll start them off with just a simple assignment. Go get the patient. Look at that patient, talk to that patient, read their chart, ignore whatever they did last time, because it's usually that. It was a haphazard mess of ideas. Ignore whatever they did last time, but read their history, look at their initial exam, talk to the patient in front of you, see how they're doing, get an idea of what they look like, and then let's choose a treatment focus. So I'll say, at the end of the day, when you write your final note, what I want you to write is, focus of today's treatment assessment was blank in order to improve blank. So I tie a focus to a functional activity or a functional thing about that patient, yeah. Right? Maybe it's ascend and descend stairs. I don't, whatever it is, right? At the far end. But in the middle there, choose a focus. And then every decision you make in the clinic should be streamlined based on that focus, right? We could choose strength today and someone else might choose balance tomorrow. That's okay. They might have been bad at both on their initial eval. But why don't we get a big treatment effect by targeting one area today in the hour that we have? And so I'll usually start with that. And then, you know, every once in a while I get the question of like, but if I'm only focused on endurance, then how am I going to make changes in this or that? And I'll say, just because you chose endurance doesn't mean you won't also get aerobic benefits. It doesn't mean you also won't improve tissue perfusion or, let's say, motor learning, right? Because motor control is such an important part of establishing normal movement patterns too, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we improve motor learning? Through many, many repetitions, right? Through practice.
Yep.
How many repetitions you can do with your endurance? Folks, maybe a lot, right? So, like, by choosing endurance, it doesn't rule out all these other potential benefits. Mm-hmm. But by choosing a treatment focus, you have now streamlined the way you think the rest of the session. You're able to clinically reason every decision you make. Mm-hmm. So that's where I usually start with those folks. And I try to continue to always keep that in mind when I'm treating patients, is that what are we going to work on today? It doesn't have to be the same thing we'll work on tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Maybe it should be. And you'll know that based on the history, interview, all the information you've gathered on the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Today's session, today's single session with this patient who you may never see again, let's choose a treatment target and let's go all in. And so I think that's a good, useful practice for anybody who's trying to adapt the way that they think about some of these things.
Dude, that's – I apply the same thing with my sport performance athletes. Like if I try to – improve their conditioning and improve their strength and improve their power and improve their reaction time and speed and agility. And like, I'm going to get nothing done. They're going to get to the end. They're going to be like, what did we do today? We did a hundred different things and I'm not even tired. Like you'll get so much more if you have to develop a focus. There has to be an action towards one specific or maybe two, three specific things. And like, you know, when I'm, I'll build up maybe to one specific, sport simulation movement, let's say. So like for my runners, I'm building up towards improving their running form by having them do, I'm working on lateral hips, doing some sort of like ground-based movement, and then they're doing the same similar thing, but now they're standing on one leg, and now they're doing a lateral step up, and then they do a lateral march, and then a lateral skip, and then lateral high knees, and then I'll watch them run, and I'm like, oh, look, your running form is better because we built up, but we didn't try to do a million different things. The focus was improve your running form today.
Yeah.
How do we do that? We've got to build up, and I've got to teach you how to do it with an open chain exercise and then build on top of that a closed chain exercise and then get it, you know, a little more movement specific and then a little bit more and then a little bit more and then boom, we've got some traction here, you know? So,
yeah.
But yeah, early on the tendency was like, okay, I've got to get your balance improved. And once we do that, well, first of all, I've got to warm up your nervous system. So we got to do these exercises over here. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then like, but you know what, before that, shoot, I'm too far ahead. We've got to do a dynamic warm-up. I got to get you completely loose. I've got to get you mobile. I've got to improve, you know, your posture. And then, oh, you know what? I forgot. I got to teach you how to breathe. You don't even know how to breathe. I mean, you're standing here in front of me, and you're alive. But you obviously don't know how to breathe. So, like, it's so easy to just – you get in a downward spiral of, like, oh, I got to do this. I got to do this. I got to do this. And it's like
– yeah.
There's a time and a place for all those things.
For sure. For sure. The other spiral I run into, I see a lot in the clinic, is – we're going to start off and we're going to focus on lumbopelvic motor control. And so you're going to be on the mat table on your back, and we're going to be doing these pelvic tilts and these other things. We're going to be getting really good at motor control. And then we're just going to keep working on motor control. And then now 6 weeks have gone by and we're still working on motor control.
Still working on it.
Man, either they got to start putting in the work at home and you really need to work on getting up to do that, or it's time to move on and get on to something else. And, you know, maybe it's just as simple as let's get off the mat from lying on our backs where we have all this tactile input and we don't move to sitting, to standing, and let's keep it moving. But at some point in time, we got to keep it moving. Or
got to progress.
What else going on here? Like, we had this guy a while back who for the longest time we treated in our clinic, and everyone was like, he has no lumbopelvic motor control. It's terrible. I don't know what's going on with this guy. It's awful. Turns out, 2 years later, we got him back in the clinic. He had Parkinson's.
Wow.
It was early, you know. Yeah. It was early, so we weren't getting the.
You were seeing the other stuff.
But like, you were probably never gonna get good at that.
Wow.
You know,
that's
so
interesting. So yeah.
Maybe there's a couple of options. Maybe, you know, it's move on and let's see what else we can do or employ. Or maybe let's get him back to another. You know, you get seen by his provider and see if there's another something else that we need to be looking at.
Yeah.
Going on here, but. For the longest time, we couldn't get this guy to pelvic tilt. We couldn't get this guy to move the way we wanted to move. And at some point in time, he got frustrated and must have gave up. I don't know. You know, I don't remember how he discharged. And again, I moved away for a year and come back. But here I am 2 years later from the first time I met the guy, and we're treating for Parkinson's. He has no back pain, but we're moving in a Parkinson's focus, and he's doing a lot better with addressing movement impairments from that standpoint. So
yeah. Wow, that's – things are way more complex most of the time than we think they are.
Way more complex. And I've sat in on like MRI technicians doing MRIs and talking to them, and they're like, you have no idea how many people never make it to your clinic because they get an MRI machine early for that back pain, and it turns out they have enlarged kidney or they have something going on.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I guess there's a whole population of people that I'll never see that came to you with back pain but actually ended up being something else.
That's crazy.
We're taught to do medical screening and to make sure we're looking for those things. But if the health model is working correctly, those things should get kind of caught early. And so we're not even seeing them. So
yeah.
Interesting.
That's crazy. That's really cool.
I think those are the big things. The other thing I wanted to mention was we're talking about psychosocial stuff. Mm-hmm. We do in my clinic use an outcome measure. And we don't use it necessarily to track progress, although we'll get some sense of progress with it, but it's more as a an information tool, like a screening tool, and it's called the pain catastrophizing scale. And I don't think you have to, I think it's free online if you're worth looking at. And
it sounds scary.
Well, it's just labeled PCS on it, you know, so
okay,
you don't
get
the words, but
that's better.
Yeah. But it's questions like, you know, the one that pops in my mind right away is just that I feel like I can't go on. Or questions that say I worry all the time about whether or not the pain will end. And you give a number of 0 to 4 in terms of the severity of which you think those things. And it's interesting to see what people will answer. You know, sometimes you get a patient who you would think would never put all these numbers, these higher scoring numbers on there, and they do. you know, or you get this lady who's, like I have this lady right now who's got diffuse arm pain both sides, just the putting on a blood pressure cuff sends her through the roof.
Wow.
But you would never know that by her affect.
Mm-hmm.
She's cool as can be. She's super sweet, polite, but when you ask her about her pain, it's severe, and it's severe to the touch. And the explanation behind the severity of her pain is a mystery in regards to, like, when you go through her comorbid history, if you go through and do a physical exam on her, it's not orthopedic special testing, orthopedic examination does not turn up, like, neck symptoms or does not turn up shoulder pain that's causing radiating pain on her arms. It's like this diffuse pain that she gets. She's been diagnosed with fibromyalgia in the past, but again, that's a diagnosis of exclusion, so that's not even necessarily a nice, hard thing you can hang your hat on in terms of what's going on. We're just making improvements, and we're playing a little bit with some of these, with tissue perfusion, some of these things we talk about with autonomic nervous system, and she's slowly experiencing improvements, but that PCS is super low, despite the fact that she's, you put a blood pressure cuff on her, not even pump it up, but just put it on her arm, and she feels like light strips are on her arm, but and then pump it up, and you've destroyed her. She's in pain the rest of the weekend, she'll tell you.
Wow.
But when you talk to her in person, the state of what I'm looking for, like the urgency in which to change the situation doesn't come off when you're talking to her. She just seems like she's doing just fine. But when you get talking to her about her pain, it's severe. So it's interesting to see that disconnect. And that tool helps us kind of understand some of those psychosocial risk factors and maybe playing a role in someone's pain experience.
Yeah, it's not enough to just say, hey, how you feel today? Oh, I feel okay. Like, what does that mean? Like,
yeah. And so I'm not in any way, shape, or form a licensed, health mental health provider. But that tool at least gives me an idea of the lay of the land.
For sure.
And if it's high, maybe that's a great reason to refer someone to the professional that could make a difference on that.
Definitely.
I had one lady who turned to me after filling it out and said, I had no idea someone was able to articulate the way I feel all the time this well.
Wow.
So, okay, we better, you know, see if there's someone who can help you address some of these thoughts you believe.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Shoot, man.
Yeah, man.
That's important stuff. Like, that's peeling back a layer.
For sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Shoot, well, let's transition a little bit. What are you learning right now?
What am I learning
anything
right now?
So, or listening to any cool podcasts, you know, like mine?
Yeah, I've been listening to your podcast, so I'm playing I'm in a very selfish way, not so patient-centered, but personally centered. I'm playing a little bit with my nutrition right now.
Good.
I got a copy of your book and found it to be super intuitive, first off. It's just easy to pick up and figure out, but it really opened up my mind to some of my habits and my decision making. So just to fill you in, a lot of what I'm doing right now. So I let's go back a little bit. So starting in like maybe March, decided I was going to do this 50K with some friends.
Mm-hmm.
I thought like, I want to race. I want to beat up on my friends a little bit and let's see how it goes. And so I started training. And like really training, like resistance training that was really specific to my goals and did a nice, I think I did a really good job of programming, like training for running, you know, a nice progressive model for that with some speed stuff built in and some distance runs and just trying to really be good about it and even mixed in some diaphragmatic breathing stuff. And so I went deep in the woods on that. But I was ignoring, we were eating good, like healthy, you know, eating
quality
foods, if you will, but certainly not paying attention to what it was in terms of ratios of carbs, fats, proteins, total calories, and just eating kind of basically what my wife's eating. And leading up to a race I did in May, a 25K I did in May, I was feeling pretty good. Tired for sure. Like noticing like, man, I put in the work, I'm tired, but like not feeling, feeling like I could do it. I could race that race. I raced that 25K. I did pretty well, but I came into it like dead legs. Like, wow, I've never experienced like complete like quad fatigue to the point where like I was running on straight legs coming in. And then coming off of that race, gave myself a couple days to recover, went to go for a run. Could not run. Could not make it a quarter mile. Pain down my lateral quad and significant knee pain. And I work as a physical therapist, right? So thinking like, I got a pretty good handle on this, but I am going to talk to a couple people at work and see what they think's going on. And like, could not hang my hat on like, it's this or that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh yeah, I know it's definitely sophomore pain, but like, why?
Yeah.
You know? And starting to do tests and measures and just being like, I don't have a clear answer. And at the end of the day, now I'm reading your book and thinking about it, like, dude, my body has been underfueled for like months.
Yeah.
Months.
Yeah. What do you expect?
It's and like, gonna happen. What kind of adaptations was I making? You know what I mean? Leading up to that thing, I ran a 16-mile run maybe like week before, and I was like, well, you know, I'm tired, but whatever. We'll go out and run that race and race it, and my body's destroyed. And so that knocked me out for a while. I would say like the better part of like 6 weeks, I could not get back to running.
Yeah.
Tried to do as much as I can to stay on top of it by rehabbing, like using other things like blood flow restriction and just jogging on a trampoline just to reduce load.
Yep.
Got this cool machine called a shuttle. It's like a leg press with resistance bands. Mm-hmm. So what I would do is just put like one resistance band on and do bounding, almost like I'm walking on the moon. Just so I was still doing that plyometric load.
It's that thing that slides up.
Yeah.
Shuttle MVP.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so working on just like plyometric load, but a low load, just so that I was trying to reduce usage. And I don't know, I got to a point where like I got back on my feet and was running again, but my mileage sucked. Still leading up to a 50K, right? And then, but like whatever, I'm just gonna finish it. That's all I care about now, right? So then broke my thumb.
Ah, nice.
Then you go under anesthesia, you deal with some of the effects that has, but hey, still gonna just finish the race.
Keep doing it.
Went and did the race, finished it. Didn't love it. My body didn't love it. It was hurting pretty good afterwards. Huh. But now, in a couple of weeks following the race, starting to kind of think about like what I would do this time, what I'm gonna prepare for next. Started thinking a little bit more along the lines of nutrition. I was also listening to Kevin's podcast and started talking to Kevin a little bit. And man. I am now completely aware of the fact that, like, although I was eating healthful foods, the amounts and the ratios of what I was eating, terrible. So I'm trying my best. This is my first week in doing it.
Yeah.
I'm trying my best to get everything on track. It's opened my eyes to a lot in regards to, like, what we're eating and how much and I think I'm figuring it out, but it's gonna take some changes. Like when we go to the grocery store this week, what I'm buying is gonna be different, like very different. I hope I'm eating, you know, the same way we're eating, but modifying what it is I'm eating at each meal and how much, for sure. So I'm excited about that. We're going to Orange Theory tonight. My wife gets off work. We're going to Orange Theory tonight, and I'm excited after a couple of days of hitting, like for sure.
Calories.
My calories to see how I feel and how much energy I have. So it'd be a cool first test today early, but I still am just excited to see what happens.
Yeah.
But I tell you my area of interest right now, what I'm kind of focusing on is, I'm looking at, like we talked about during the podcast earlier, the respiratory muscle performance stuff. For sure, interested in it because I want to make sure I figure out how to make it my own. Despite it being a research study that's ongoing in our clinic, I don't be able to use it for patients and find meaning behind it. But I'm super interested in moving beyond just what we know about tissue capacity and loading. So, like, we talk a lot about with tendon, progressing to eccentric load and all that stuff to try to create good tensile capabilities of the tendons. But progressing from that into what's the word I'm looking for? Like neuromuscular control, like playing with timing. And let's say we've done everything we can to progress someone's tensile capabilities. Let's say they've had a patellar tendon injury. We've done anything we can to progress their tensile capabilities. But what about the experience of running. It's occurring at a cadence under a plyometric load, like starting to play with that a little bit. Mm-hmm. So neuromuscular control, the term I'm looking for is not neuromuscular control. It is, hold on, pull it up, because I'm just having a brain fart. Tendon neuroplastic training.
Playing easy one to forget.
Yeah. So playing with that, nice. Recovery and neuroplasticity of tendon, and trying to be better about progressing those patients once we've even in the process of regaining regular tensile capabilities, starting to make sure that's in the back of my mind. So I've been playing a lot with, like, I have a post-op ACL right now, and we're playing a little bit with, like, cadence training. Mm-hmm. So, like, even playing with ramp speed when we're using TENS to work on neuromuscular control, the ramp speed or the rate of firing, when we're off the table and we're doing – more loading activities, thinking about cadence, playing with cadence a little bit, and that's been fun. And so changing the way that I'm doing some of those things. But what I tend to do in a clinic is I'll start reading something I'm interested in. I'll dive way in. I'll play with it with everybody, like old ladies, young people, Parkinson's patients, ortho patients. I'll try to adapt it to their specific needs. So, like, I'm not going to use the same cadence for an old lady as I'm going to use for a young athlete, maybe. But playing with those concepts, seeing what works, and then kind of like narrowing down how I use it once I play with it with everybody. So, like, last week I was playing with stuff a ton, and it looked ridiculous at times, like what I was playing with these patients. But at the end of the day, I was able to kind of get a better appreciation for the spectrum of patients that I'm treating, and then say, you know what, it worked really well for this patient population. It went okay over there, but I'm not sure I'll use it on a regular basis. And I'm going to pass on these patients. I probably won't go that deep. So a lot of that for sure.
Yeah. That's awesome stuff, man.
Yeah, man. How about you? What are you playing with?
Right now? I've been rereading Athletic Development by Vern Gambetta.
Okay.
And like I read it in college. I read it my senior year of college, and I understood like every single word in the book. I understood, but I had absolutely no idea what the book was about. And so I think I'm starting to understand what it's about. So that's good.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, just like off podcast, we'll talk about it, because I've got lots of stuff that I've underlined that I'm like why don't I remember this. I feel like this is the first time I've read it, but I've definitely read this before.
Yeah.
This is basic. Like, I should know this. Why don't I feel like I know this and can apply it? So doing a lot of that. I'm still editing the book, my book. So
I should send you back the copy that I have. I
got some edits.
Typos.
Nice.
As I read all 90 pages, you know.
Yeah, dude, you read it in like a couple days, right? Or overnight, something crazy like that.
Yeah, I read it overnight.
Nice.
I sat there for like 4 hours and just read it. And
yeah,
like,
you do a lot of reading, so that's fine.
I do a lot of reading.
That's good. That's good stuff.
Yeah, I think it's the way to stay relevant. Is keep up on what's changing, and then try to form your own opinions on things and adapt and play with it. I'd love to someday be in a lab where I get to, like, actually, like, you know, like, I'm paid to play with this stuff and then write about it. But as it is right now, I enjoy being a citizen scientist, you know, just taking what I'm reading and making my own and figuring out how to make it work with the patients I have.
For sure. Yeah, no, that's a good place to be. My guess is eventually you'll probably end up wanting to have one foot in each side of the industry. So, and you're kind of there, like you're teaching the next generation, and
I'm sure
that'll lead into some sort of research role at some point. And then
I've missed performance. I will say that. So lately I've even started to kind of dip my toes into like having some private client stuff. Not sure like that I love, like, the be honest, like, love the going to someone's home or going to someone's personal gym and doing that stuff. Like, I'd like to be in my own space. But when you're dealing with, like, progressing patients to graduation, you know, and no longer being in the clinic, and the patients are expressing the desire to continue to work with somebody, I've had a couple patients that, like, we've sort of worked out an arrangement where, like, maybe I can come a couple times and we can work on some things and kind of figure that out and kind of move away from what we're doing in the clinic, because obviously I have to still be protective of my role as physical therapist. But I can wear both hats since my background is beyond physical therapy.
Yep.
And kind of throwing on the other hat for a little bit and going to work and having some fun. And it's been cool to return to performance once in a while, and I miss it. Just because I live in a world where I'm treating mostly, like I said, people with comorbid conditions in addition to pain, and that's super rewarding in its own way and takes a lot of additional thought. But being able to, like, go to work and just, like, watch somebody really thrive is nice. And I miss that at times.
Oh, yeah. I hear that. I completely understand that.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. So.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, any words of advice for me or for anyone watching or listening?
I my only advice would be watch out for listeners, you and me, like, watch out for the people that think they got it figured out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just so much that we don't know and so much to be learned. Like, if someone's got it figured out, I'm calling shenanigans.
They don't got it.
Always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The more you know, the more you realize there's a whole lot of stuff you don't know. So if you think you've got
it. Confident, but you need to be careful about the way in which you project that confidence and so as to not, you know, you can't know everything. You just can't.
For sure. So, that's the truth, man.
That's all I got.
Sweet. Well, how can people follow you? How can they find you? How can they ask you questions? And all of that.
I should have prepped that a little bit. I am on Twitter. I am on Instagram. I believe it's my first name, I-A-N, my middle initial M, and my last name, R-H-E-A-U-L-T. I'd be willing to bet that's it for both those accounts. I can't say I'm super social media active, but if I get something from somebody, I absolutely respond.
Awesome.
I absolutely respond. And you'll find a picture of me somewhere out there on each one of those things. That's current, you know, that reflects long hair and a beard. Yeah, I'm out there. I don't know.
Awesome.
So that's what
awesome.
I would do. I would search those things on those platforms.
I'll find them first, and then I'll put them in the description of the video and the audio, just to make sure.
Yeah. So. I'm not out there selling content. Or pushing an agenda. And not that people who are out there doing that are, you know, that's another way to really learn new stuff is to get your name out there and to engage in conversation. I haven't quite figured that out yet. I think I've got a pretty cool network of people that I reach out to pretty often, like you, like some of my mentors here, and friends that are elsewhere learning cool things. And so I probably need to be better about engaging the social media community. I'm out there. I have a presence. I just haven't done a ton of reaching out. I read a lot of stuff people are writing about.
Yeah.
I need to reach back and start engaging. So that's a good call to action.
You're a consumer, not a producer, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's the truth of it.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Ian, thank you so much for your time. This has been extremely educational. I really appreciate it. And I know that anyone else who watches or listens will pull quite a bit from it, and hopefully they will apply it. So
yeah, I appreciate the invite, man.
Awesome. We'll get you on again in the future. We'll be able to talk more shop and
I love that.
Relive some old memories probably. And let me know next time you're in Dallas.
Will do.
Awesome. Alrighty, y'all. Thanks again, and stay tuned for the next episode next week.